My name's Joel, and we're in the book of Samuel in the Old Testament, which is largely the story of David's life. David's one of the heroes of the Bible, and we've been learning a lot about the latter part of his life. So we're in 2 Samuel, which is like the second half. It's going to be another one of those messages where we're looking at the failures in his life. 2 Samuel has a lot to say about the dark side of David's life, the failures, particularly today in the area of fatherhood. There's a lot hanging on this message because this is relevant to all of us individually. We've all experienced some kind of contact with fatherhood. We've all had fathers. Some of us are fathers. Some of us intend to be fathers. Some of us might be about to be fathers. Some of us have been fathers. And so this is a message that is relevant in different ways, but certainly relevant to each person. So I'm going to read to you from 2 Samuel 13 and 20 onwards, verse 20 onwards. Now, just to say, we're coming in on the story at the point where Amnon, David's son, has committed this horrible violation of his sister, his half-sister. Basically sexually abused her, raped her. So this is an ugly story. And they're both children of David. And so we're picking up the story from a dark, dark place. But let me read from there and take the story on. Her brother Absalom said to her, "Has Amnon your brother been with you? Now hold your peace, my sister. He is your brother. Do not take this to heart." So Tamar lived, a desolate woman, in her brother Absalom's house. When King David heard of all these things, he was very angry. But Absalom spoke to Amnon neither good nor bad, for Absalom hated Amnon because he had violated his sister Tamar. After 2 full years, Absalom had sheep shearers at Baal Hazor, which is near Ephraim. And Absalom invited all the king's sons. Absalom came to the king and said, "Behold, your servant has sheep shearers. Please let the king and his servants go with your servant." Just a bit of context here. Sheep shearers was a bigger deal, okay, in this culture than ours. Okay, if I was today, 21st century Brighton, Hove, Shoreham, to say let's get together for a sheep shearing, I reckon not many of you would prioritize it. It doesn't get us excited. In the given culture of this story, it's a bit like a kind of Glastonbury stroke Wimbledon stroke Ascot. It's the kind of summer thing. It's kind of let's hang out, let's drink Pimm's, let's have lemonade, let's have sheep, and let's shear those sheep, and let's make it a big deal. Let's celebrate the shearing of the sheep. You know, this is kind of what I've been saving up for all year. This moment where I get to shear some damn sheep. It's so good. And it's a big deal. So you've got to just put yourself contextually. You know, it's a different moment. Just get in their world, get in their zone, celebrate the sheep along with me. Okay, but the king said to Absalom, "No, my son, let us not all go, lest we be burdensome to you." He pressed him, but he would not go, but gave him his blessing. Then Absalom said, "If not, please let my brother Amnon go with us." You see what Absalom's doing here? He's still bearing this 2-year-long grudge and hatred for his brother. And the king said to him, "Why should he go with you?" But Absalom pressed him. Now, David maybe at this point is suspicious. Why should he go? What's going on? What are you going to do to him, Absalom? But Absalom pressed him until he let Amnon and all the king's sons go with him. Then Absalom commanded his servants, "Mark when Amnon's heart is merry with wine, and when I say to you, strike Amnon, then kill him. Do not fear. Have I not commanded you? Be courageous, be valiant." So the servants of Absalom did to Amnon as Absalom had commanded. Then all the king's sons arose, and each mounted his mule and fled. While they were on their way, news came to David, "Absalom has struck down all the king's sons, and not one of them is left." And the king arose and tore his garments and lay on the earth, and all his servants who were standing by tore their garments. But Jonadab, the son of Shimea, David's brother, said, "Let not my lord suppose that they have killed all the young men, the king's sons, for Amnon alone is dead. For by the command of Absalom, this has been determined from the day he violated his sister Tamar. Now, therefore, let not my lord the king so take it to heart as to suppose that all the king's sons are dead, for Amnon alone is dead. But Absalom fled. The young man who kept the watch lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, many people were coming from the road behind him by the side of the mountain. And Jonadab said to the king, behold, the king's sons have come, as your servant said, so it has come about. And as soon as he finished speaking, behold, the king's sons came and lifted up their voice and wept. And the king also and all his servants wept very bitterly. But Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Ammihud, king of Geshur. David mourned for his son day after day. So Absalom fled and went to Geshur and was 3 years there. And the spirit of the king longed to go out to Absalom, because he was comforted about Amnon, since he was dead. So we've been only recently hearing in the news from a Labour Member of Parliament in London called David Lammy. He was referring to personal loss that he's undergone through the disastrous, the horrifying events in Notting Hill with the Grenfell Tower. The last time I remember David Lammy speaking up in a way that caught the nation's attention in a particular way, I suppose like this, was a long time back after the riots in 2011 in North London, which sparked off in Tottenham and then spread across the capital and then even into other cities. And there was a whole load of conversation in the media and in public places afterwards, where people discussed the causes. Why is it that hundreds, if not thousands, of mostly young people took to the streets to defy the law, to smash shops up, to steal things, to create havoc, burn buildings down? It was shocking. It was frightening. It really set the nation on edge in a way, I suppose, comparable to what we've been going through these last few weeks. And David Lammy, he wrote a piece that caught people's attention when he pointed out, having observed himself, some of the trials of those who were taken to court from Tottenham, particularly where it started out in North London. He said of the 19 that were charged in the courts, two of them had fathers who were present in their, or had been present in their lives. And he drew attention to the fact, saying this is surely the issue. If not one of the important issues, it's perhaps the issue that we ignore to our cost. He was drawing attention to the fatherlessness of a generation of young people who haven't been trained and taught. And he was showing reasonably, without being sensational or hysterical, he was just very simply and plainly and reasonably pointing out what seems to be a fairly sensible link between what we see in society's view of fatherhood, and have seen over the last generation particularly, and the beginnings of cracks in social cohesion and identity amongst the young. And it was showing, it was expressing itself through this kind of violence and rioting. And he drew out some other statistics that were that ought to shock us. You're saying that back in 1972, one in 14 households, families, were raised by a single parent. One in 14. At the time of the riots, it was one in four. It'd gone from one in 14 to one in four in a generation. House families with one single parent. And the vast majority of those situations, the father has gone. The vast majority of single parent situations, it's a mother bringing up children on her own, no father around. That is a startling statistic. There were others as well. He talked about the local authority of Camden, also in North London, where the percentage of children raised in families without a father was 62%. And then going across the nation, 236. The local authorities in England and Wales, 236 equivalents to Camden, where it's over 50% are being raised in households without a father. This has happened not gradually. This is a shift that has accelerated exponentially in a generation. It has been massive. And the impact socially is something we begin to feel. There's a sense that there isn't the sort of diligent fathering which involves loving authority, loving discipline, loving training and care, caring enough to prepare, especially young men, towards a lifestyle which will be productive and fruitful and a blessing to society. That seems to have diminished almost completely in some quarters of the world, and we see the results. We see them sometimes in ways that are shocking, that grab our attention, grab the headlines, and so on. So this is actually a relevant subject socially. What we see in this story is a microcosm of that. We see a father, David, a great man, one of the greatest men in history, no question. One of the great achievers and heroes, certainly one of the heroes of the Bible, perhaps the hero of the Old Testament. As a father, he failed. No question, he failed. We can't get around that. And the failure reaped a terrible harvest. So he got sons who he didn't raise right. And Amnon rapes his half-sister. Absalom in this story wreaks bloodthirsty revenge, which he plots for 2 years. And later on in the story, you won't know from now, but Absalom's own story is terribly dark, tragic, heartbreaking. And then Adonijah, the next brother down, who becomes king, also suffers a violent death. These are boys who never became men. Boys who were never fathered. And having not been fathered by their father, it's as though there's a vacuum that gets filled by the wrong party. In Amnon's case, he doesn't get fathered by David, he therefore gets dealt with by the sword. And that's really the easy fate, the likely way forward, especially for boys who are not fathered properly. This is what the state ends up trying to deal with. The state tries to step in a way that in often cases diminishes the dignity of fathers, seems to rob them of their role and their opportunity even. The state can't be a father. A policeman, a police force, a judge, a prison cell, a community service, an ASBO, cannot be a father. And yet this is what we rely upon. This is the lever we pull, the switch we press, because there's no other solution. Let's just deal with these terrible boys. Deal with these scum who we don't know. Let's just punish them with usually sort of meaningless things that can feel, even at the time, like nothing more than a slap on a wrist. My fear is that gradually society will get less and less and less mild in the way it deals with people. There's only two ways to go. You either become more anarchic or you become more strong and heartless and authoritarian. You don't just put kids in cells, you do other things to them as well. Because this is the only way we can control them. And they were never meant to be controlled by the state. Amnon was never meant to be butchered by his brother. He was meant to be sat down and talked to by his father. He was meant to be led. He was meant to be cared for. He was meant to be talked through the phases of life. He was never given a chance. And there are thousands, hundreds and hundreds of thousands who walk the same path today in our streets and our cities. So this is massively relevant to your life and mine. And I want to look at his failure in a few stages and just learn, because this is our call, especially for some of you would-be fathers, present fathers. Maybe some of you, this is a painful subject because you have been fathers and you might feel I'm touching things that are sensitive, turning over old things that you don't want turn over. And that's not my intention. I want to serve you, I want to help, and I want to see what God could do in our generation as people step up to this role with dignity. See, fatherhood is genuinely at the heart of the universe. It's no incidental thing to God's plan. If you are a father living with children, you are not flatmates. You're not roommates. there's something sacred going on. You know that one of the names God has is in the New Testament, Ephesians chapter 3, verse 15, where Paul, describing God, says he is the Father from whom all fatherhoods are named, or every family in heaven and earth is named. Different translations put it family or fatherhood. But the point is, every fatherhood or every family that exists where there's a father is a microcosm. Or no, better still, a photocopy. It's a kind of a show-off. This is a version of the original. God the Father is the original Father. That's who he is. That's who he is most essentially. In fact, if we were to go out into the streets of Brighton Hove and Shoreham and say to strangers, what's the word you come up with when I say God? What describes God? What is God first and foremost? 9 out of 10 people will say creator. Creator. But if you're saying that, you've already got it wrong. That's not what he is essentially. Do you know that God is a father before he was ever a creator? God is a father before the world began. Before anything was made, he was a father to his only begotten son, his eternally begotten son. God's fatherhood, in other words, never began. You go right back to the top. You go right back to the beginning. There is no beginning. You can't find the beginning of fatherhood. There isn't such a thing. Fatherhood is one of those things that has always been. And every fatherhood since, whether we take it seriously or not, is a copy, some kind of photocopy. It might be a terrible, you know, those old photocopies. We don't use them as much, you know, but 25th generation photocopy that you can't even read the words. That's what it can become in our hands. Fathers who disappear, fathers who do badly in all kinds of ways. They might say, well, I'm not taking it seriously. I don't believe what you... It doesn't really matter if you take it seriously or disagree with me. It doesn't. You're still preaching to your children about fatherhood. You just are. Doing it well, doing it badly. You're communicating, you're imaging, you're reflecting, you're representing God the Father. So you've got kids who are going to grow up being told to pray, Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. And every time they pray that, they'll have images in their mind. Our Father, what's a father like? Well, we're talking about God. This is a huge, weighty responsibility then. It's something that should land on us with a sense of weight, seriousness. It should make us sober up. But it's also very dignifying, don't you think? For a father to feel like he's kind of doing what God does. I get to share a role with God. That's incredibly honoring. I remember a story of Kathy Keller, who's a writer, very gifted lady. She's married to Tim Keller, who's also written loads of books. They've been really helpful. You should read their books. She said that she, as a child, wrote a letter to C.S. Lewis. He was still alive. This would be back in the late 50s, I guess, early 60s. She's very young, you know, about 10. She writes a letter saying, I am a writer. Give me your advice on being a writer. She's 10 years old. And C.S. Lewis openly writes back to her. She says something about certain people. He wrote back to this 10-year-old girl on the other side of the ocean. And she in the letter says, something that writers like you and me need to learn to do, you know, us writers, he says that a few times in the letter, us writers. You get the sense of the weightiness of being co-identified with somebody. You've got a 10-year-old girl in North America and you've got C.S. Lewis. And he says, us writers, me and you, we're the same. And she's sort of all her life lived with this dignifying sense. Yeah, me and C.S. Lewis, we're quite tight, you know. It's like that with, you know, when you, maybe you've musicians, you jammed with your favorite music, you had a weird experience where you got into a band with someone, or you sports, you know, you just fanatical about a certain athlete or a player, and you got to pass the ball around with someone, and it's like they were treating you as an equal. Like, oh, I can't believe what I'm doing. If you're a dad, you kind of do that. Isn't that extraordinary? God draws you into his confidence, says, us fathers. This is dignifying. But let's look at how, in spite of that, David takes a route that fails at key points, so that his role, his authority, his opportunity is wasted. The first thing to say before we get into it is that David before he's even started being a father, has failed in that he's not a one-woman man. This is a man with many wives. He's a man with many women, concubines and wives. David's story, many wives. Many people read the Bible and get very offended, thinking, God's wonderful heroes who have many wives, isn't that appalling? Yes, it is appalling. Don't think that God agrees with it. If you want to know what God thinks about marriage and monogamy and one man for one woman, you just read the first few pages of the Bible, you'll see what God thinks. You'll see what God thinks about people who spread their seed around, who have a few wives or a few women. That is the opposite of what God insists on, and it's the opposite of what he's like. God himself is married to a bride, his people, who are wayward, not faithful, not deserving of his love. Does he ditch them? Does he decide against them? No, he is committed to them. He stays with them. He is faithful to one bride. That is what God is like. Any man who is not a one-woman man is preaching a false God, a false father, a false husband. And no wonder our kids are confused. No wonder society's blown apart. Because kids grow up in all kinds of mixed up messages. They don't have the faithfulness of a father who's committed to the wife. This is what my son realized when he was tiny. You may have heard me say this before. I said to one of my kids, Hudson, when he was very young, I'm going to be talking to the fathers in the church soon, Hudson. What do you think I should say to them? He said, tell them to love their wives. He was only about 4 or 5 years old. Tell them to love their wives. And then he said, or God will get them. He's got something. He understood something. This is at the core of things. David was not a one-woman man, which meant that he was a tragically confused father. But let's move on for a sec. There's a few other pieces here that are utterly essential. First of all, we see the importance of a devoted love. Okay, there are three different parts of love that I want us to see in this. A devoted love, and I want us to see a present love, and I want us to see an authoritative love. But let's start with a devoted love. This is the taproot of everything else that we're going to say. If we miss this, you will not understand my next 2 points. You'll fail to, and you'll misapply them, and it won't be good. So hear me on this. This is the heart. This is the tree trunk. The other 2 points are the branches. So the first thing is this devoted love. What is a father? What is God the Father from whom all other fathers are named? What is he like? He is devoted in his love towards his son. Devoted. That's what he's like. Love from eternity, focused, determined, committed to his son, his beloved son in whom he's well pleased. You know that John's gospel is so thick with this kind of language. Jesus talks about it all the time, but especially in John's gospel, it's kind of pouring out of every chapter. John chapter 3, verse 35, where he speaks about the father, says the father loves the son and has given all things into his hand. The father loves the son and has given all things into his hand. And we must have this at the core. This is essential because a lot of fathering is saying no. A lot of fathering is disciplining. A lot of fathering is dealing with kids. A lot of good, faithful fathering doesn't look like giving all things into your hand. You have to say no a lot. I have to say no to my kids maybe 20 times a day. If my no is coming from a heart that is essentially one big fat no, because that's how I feel about my kids, then that's not God. If my no comes from a heart of yes, I want the best for you. I love you. I want to lay my life down for you. Then it's a very different story. My no is part of a great big yes. Do you see the difference? We'll talk more about that before we finish. This is huge. This persistent, devoted love. God shows it again, famously, at the baptism of Jesus. You know how Jesus comes out of the waters of the River Jordan and this dove descends, the Holy Spirit descending in the form of a dove, and there's this voice that booms out of heaven as the Father, by the power of the Spirit, declares his complete affection towards the Son. This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. This is before Jesus has done any miracles, preached any sermons. Jesus has no public ministry. Jesus has not done the things that the Father sent him to do yet. He hasn't started the things that the Father sent him to do. Doesn't matter. The Father is utterly delighted with him. This is what God is like. The pleasure of the Father over the Son. It's what we can enjoy. You may have never realized this. This is at the heart of Christianity. This is at the heart of this book's message. You might think, how could a person like me ever know genuine love from God? I know that God loves me. I've seen the smiley stickers. I know that they say that God loves everybody. I get that. I believe that's possibly true. But that's not true for me, because I know about me. And I know that God might love him and her, the people sitting near me, and maybe the preacher right now, but God would never love me. It's impossible. And I'm here to tell you, you couldn't be more wrong. You have no idea about God. You don't know what he's like. You don't know about his unpredictable, wild, surprising fatherly love. His kindness, his devotion. The way that Jesus came into the world was telling of a gloriously faithful, loving, kind, gracious, forgiving Father. That was right at the heart of his message, his famous story in Luke chapter 15, where he describes this son who takes his father's inheritance, saying to his father effectively, I want you dead. I want you dead. That's what he's saying. I want my inheritance. I want it now. In his culture, that's like saying, I want you dead. Like Absalom in this story, speaking to his father, David, come sheep shearing with me and Amnon. Why does he want that David to come? What's he doing? You all realize as the story goes on, Absalom hates his father, wants him dead. And in Absalom's case, David holds back. You might have noticed, well, actually, it comes up later on in the story, in fact, chapter 14. Absalom eventually, after the estrangement, after the murder of Amnon, comes back to Jerusalem. But his relationship to his father is never healed. The circle is never closed. It says in 14, verse 28, so Absalom lived 2 full years in Jerusalem without coming into the king's presence. And Jerusalem wasn't a big city like this one, not spread out the same way. He was probably only a few hundred yards away. They never spoke again for 2 years. David didn't go out to find him, didn't wait for him, didn't look out for him, in spite of how much his heart was broken for him, he didn't show that devotion and that love to him. He didn't reach out to him at all. He didn't love him truly. Not fully, not rightly, not the way that God does. You look in the stories Jesus told. You know the story? The prodigal son, I'm just beginning to describe. The boy takes his father's wealth, squanders it on prostitutes, on wild living, ends up in shame, feeding the pigs, which in his culture would have been utterly shameful, comes back to his father smelling of pig's food and wasted all the money, utterly sort of bedraggled and ruined by his own foolishness. His father sees him from the distance, which suggests that he's on the roof watching the horizon. Will he come back? When will I see my son? Sees him on the horizon, goes downstairs, descends down, pulls up his skirts, his robes, as they'd have had, and runs to his son. You do not do that in first century Judea. Fathers, you got even Middle Eastern fathers now, that's not done. That's not dignified. That's not the way, especially in that culture at that time. You wouldn't show off your legs as you run towards you. No, that's what servants do. I'm going to wait for him to come here if he wants to talk to me. That's not what our God is like. He's prepared to run to us in our shame, in our mess, stuff that we're embarrassed about, our humiliation. He runs to us and embraces us, covers us with new garments and berings our fingers and sits us at the table, calls us sons, royalty in his house. This is our God. This is his way. David was not that way with his son. At a distance, cold, aloof, not sure how to engage with him. The devotion that he received from his father in heaven wasn't extended onwards. And fathers, this is at the taproot of our calling towards children. He was a present, or sorry, he failed to be a present father, and so the present love wasn't there either. You see that in a couple of mentions. In verse 21 of chapter 13, King David heard about Tamar's rape and was very angry. But that's where it stopped. It doesn't go any further. David's angry. He's angry. Well, well done, David. It's better to be angry than not. It's horrible what happened to your daughter. You should be angry. If you weren't, you would be a robot or a monster. Well done for your anger, but what will happen? Will you present yourself in the situation or will you hold back? And he doesn't present himself at all. He doesn't get his hands dirty. He doesn't get involved. He doesn't deliver justice. He doesn't protect his daughter. He doesn't think about that. He doesn't even seem to want to. And I have to guess at this point because the Bible isn't explicit, but perhaps what's going on here is David is remembering his own failure before. He knows that he blew it. He brought so much upon himself. Bathsheba, who he slept with, another man's wife, then he had the man bumped off. David has failed spectacularly, and it's possible, like so many people since, he's seen his own failure and believed that that disqualifies him from standing up to take responsibility for others. This is the thing that so many will hide behind. I can't speak to him. I can't deal with him. I was worse when I was his age. I did those things. I can't speak into, I just have to leave it. That's a false equation. It may be true that you were worse, but that doesn't rob, that doesn't diminish your duty to care, to speak, to say, don't walk that way. Maybe you could even say, I did walk that way. Don't do it. But he seems to feel, I've got no place to say anything. I can understand David's reticence, but I can't condone it. And no one should. No one should. Very often leaders feel, I can't speak into this. Look, I'm stained, I'm ashamed. I can't speak into the situation. And maybe you feel you can't, but actually you sometimes must because it's your responsibility in a given moment. So he's not present, he's not devoted, and finally, he's not authoritative in the life of his sons. You see this in verse 27 where Absalom presses him about Amnon. Now, David already is suspicious. You can tell that from the dialogue, but he doesn't get any trouble from David in the end. Absalom can get past him. He says, Absalom pressed him until he let Amnon and all the king's sons go with him. Amnon got past David. He got past him. That's strange. Not many people could get past David. Goliath didn't get past David. Saul didn't get past David in the end. The Jebusites in Jerusalem, a whole city didn't get past David. He was unstoppable. He was a machine. It seems like David is incredibly clear on the frontiers of his kingdom. His ambitions, his empire building, what I want to see done. I want to spread my name. And maybe that's not wrong. He did have a great name. God had given him a great calling, a great destiny. Having a sense of destiny, friends, is not a problem. Having a long-sighted sense of destiny is. Where you can't see the thing closest to you, where you don't see the little church in your own house. You don't see the need for people around you to be nurtured and spoken to and cared for. That's the story of a lot of leaders, even pastors. I'm sure in my life it's at least occasionally been the story. I don't want to be like David here. I want God to help me. You need the same, to be present, to be close, and even to not let children past me. Actually, you see this later on in Adonijah's life. It's quite a revealing verse at the beginning of 1 Kings. And it says about him, verse 6 of chapter 1, his father had never at any time displeased him by asking, why have you done thus and so? His father never displeased him. Isn't that the story of so many? His father never displeased him. He was terrified of displeasure. I can't displease him. Where does this weakness come from? It's there. And God, I need your help with this. I need your help, Lord, to believe for better, long for better things for my sons, for my daughters. I don't want to let them drift through. I want to speak with authority, not because I'm trying to control them and make them into my little kind of parts of my empire, but because God's plan for their life is so great. I want to have better ambitions and hopes and dreams for my children. I have for myself. They're not mine, they're borrowed from God. They're my entrustment, but they're not my possession. And I need to serve them. I serve them often. I serve them often by being that force of discipline. By having to be that restraint that a boy like an Adonijah or an Absalom or an Amnon did not have. There's no restraint, there's no influence, there's no wisdom, there's nothing. It leads to disaster. You see it in Proverbs. This is one of the things Solomon, his final son, who did become king later, says this in verse 18 of chapter 19. Discipline your son, for there is hope. Do not be a willing party to their death. That's what a father who doesn't discipline is doing. Actually, he's kind of condoning their destruction. That's what you see that literally happen in these boys' lives. And it will happen in city after city in our lifetime unless something changes. It will happen in our church. It will happen in churches. It will happen in the lives of children unless fathers plead with God and start by loving their sons and daughters enough to speak to them, to sit them down. Yes, sometimes to say no, sometimes to, if necessary, be clear and disciplining and forceful, making sure that they're not wayward, making sure that we love them enough. My dad was from a non-Christian home. His dad wasn't a Christian, not until the very last stages of his life when he turned to Christ. So my father grew up without any Christianity, and he used to come home drunk quite often. And his father would just laugh, just found it funny. Just that's what boys do, it's just funny. I came home drunk once. My mum found me the next day. She said to me, do you know that your dad couldn't get to sleep last night? Just up crying. Crying. So what had happened? In a generation, something changed. A man said, I won't have that in my household. I will pray, I will weep, I will cry out to God for my sons. I will fight for them. He didn't. You want to know what a gracious, loving, tender person he is and he was. The way he handled me was extraordinary. He prayed for me. He prayed for me. He fought for me. Yeah, and he certainly needed to use discipline sometimes. But he did it out of this devoted love, present love. We need we need in our time fathers who do that. That's what Brighton needs more than anything else. I don't care what you think. That's what it needs. More than any political solution, more than anything the state tries to cook up, more than any funding, more than anything. Nothing will change unless godly fathers step in. And right now they are stepping out in their thousands. They're abdicating and the world weeps. Sons grow up rudderless, without even a compass, without even a grasp of what life is about, wreck society. We'll see worse to come, I predict it, unless God breaks in. And that means, guys especially, you and I stepping up. That's the stakes. I'm not being melodramatic. I know I'm preaching, but this is what God says. This is God's heart. And the statistics should be enough to humble us. It's no small matter. David discovered that to his cost eventually. So being able to speak with authority, being a father with presence, loving, gracious, with authority. Even Kurt Cobain said it in one of his songs. You may know one of the Nirvana tracks. He says, I tried to have a father, but what I got was a dad. You kind of know what he means. Just want to be mates. Just want to go. Just let them go. Just let it go. No. A father will fight for his sons. A God the Father. He pleads for, longs for, fights for, even disciplines wisely for. And this is the only way for us, really. Because if we don't come under God's fatherly care, we're left to ourselves. That's what the nation seems to have chosen. We reject fatherhood. We think that we're getting ourselves free. We undermine fatherhood at every stage. And by the way, this isn't just about social policy and tax systems. This isn't about that primarily. Social policy follows society. This was happening years before. This was happening with sexual permissiveness. When we sell the story to the world that, guys, you just enjoy your life. You just sleep around, get free, follow your heart. We dress it up with all kinds of nonsense. Just follow my heart. I've got to go with her now. I've got to go with her. Oh, no, I just... What are you talking about? What about your responsibility? What about these? What about these children? And we've sown that idea through Hollywood, through music, through poetry, through plays, through culture. No wonder the politicians gradually dismantle the institution of fatherhood. They didn't start it. It started way before the state got involved. And if society can change because of people like that, then society can change because the church rises up. That's our calling in our generation. God help us to do it. God help us. That's the only way it can happen. Because I can't do it. I'm no good as a father without God's help. None of us are. A message like this can leave a lot of us on the floor thinking, oh, woe is me. Maybe some of you feel like you failed. But this is whole point is it's a story of grace. If you failed as a father, so have I. Join me. I'm one of you. If you feel like you've been scarred by bad fathering, God's ability to redeem and change things is incredible. God's ability to raise you up and use you as a father, as a parent, or in spiritual fathering, in serving people that come into your life who've never had a father, what kind of a blessing you could be. You could decide today to be a part of the answer for people, but never in your own strength. Never because you are the hero, super dad turned up. But because God the Father, with his incredible grace, has said yes to you through the cross. Through the cross, this Father came down. He descended the staircase. He ran to us, ran to the hill, taking on the shame. Everyone's watching this despised character as he's hung up naked on a tree. What's this showing us? It's showing us what God is like. If you feel ashamed of your failure, if you feel hurt by the past, come to the cross. Come to the forgiver. Come to the great forgiver, the great healer who washes your sins away, treats you as his own. Come to Christ. Come to the Father through the Son. Do you know what it's like being in Christ? It's being adopted, being cherished, having God the Father look at you and say, "You are my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased." You are. Yeah, you. Me? Yes, absolutely. In Christ you are. In Christ alone.